Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. From March 2007 until last spring, four-star Admiral William Fox Fallon was the combatant commander of U.S. Central Command. Top brass, number one U.S. military commander across the globe's hottest region, Egypt to Pakistan. He ran two nasty wars and the hunt for al-Qaeda, had a view about as big as it gets of the world's tough spots and their challenges, and a reputation for speaking truth to power. It's a good time for that. This hour on Point, Admiral William Fallon on a world of threat and opportunity as a new administration takes the stage. You can join the conversation. What's your question for the fighter pilot admiral who once ran your country's wars? What's your question for William Fallon today on Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan, Gaza, on smart power, on al-Qaeda? Joining me now in the studio is William Fox Fallon, retired four-star admiral, former commander of U.S. Pacific Command and of U.S. Central Command. Named CENTCOM chief under George W. Bush in March 2007, abruptly retired in March 08 after appearing to fall out with the White House over Iran policy. These days, he surveys the world from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, where he is a fellow at the school's Center for International Studies. Admiral William Fallon, thank you very much for being here.
Tom, a pleasure to be here with you.
So is it a relief not to have all those stars on the shoulder and the big gold-encrusted cap, or how's it feel? So almost a year out now.
Well, I'm still adjusting. No real relief. I like to run around at high speed, and my wife is continually asking me when this retirement stuff's going to actually kick in.
Yes, we can see that. Our friend David Ignatius at the Washington Post says when you left that post, head of CENTCOM, that he had seen a lot of good come from having a headstrong blowtorch of a man speaking truth to power. Truth to power is not exactly what we always think of when we think of top commanders necessarily in the U.S. military. I mean, how did you get so high as such a blowtorch of a guy? Is wide-open candor welcome in the U.S. military?
Well, I don't know about the blowtorch business.
Peel paint off
David's,
the walls.
Yeah, that was an interesting comment.
He was in the meetings
David.
With you.
But it's a lot of years of service to the nation. I'm very, very pleased to have been in that position and be able to help out. A lot of time learning about issues and learning about people and having experiences that hopefully were of some value. I believe that you need to honestly assess situations and not be afraid to tell people what you think. And I think that's expected of our leaders, and I believe that the vast majority of them do exactly that.
We want to look at the present circumstances today, and we want to look forward with you, Admiral, but let us just understand for a moment. When you left your very senior post, about as high as it gets in the U.S. military out in the field, last March, it was after this article came out that portrayed you as the last man standing between the United States and war with Iran. Was that accurate? And why did you leave the post?
Well, I don't think that was particularly accurate. I certainly had opinions about our engagement in the Middle East and the difficulty for me of dealing with Iraq, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, with Iran in between. Clearly, in my view, we had to deal with things inside those countries, and they were being handled by our commanders, Dan McNeil in Afghanistan and Dave Petraeus in Iraq.
Dave Petraeus, who has now succeeded you in the position at CENTCOM.
Yes. Mm-hmm. But the these places don't exist in a vacuum, and Iran was having a significant influence on activities in Iraq, very detrimental, I would say, particularly in the end of 2006, early 2007, and it seemed to me that we were going to have to deal with that. But the circumstances of my departure were unfortunate because we had this huge blow-up of publicity that seemed to focus on me and whether or not I was in some kind of a dispute with the president, which I was not. But the upshot of all this publicity is diverting attention, certainly at that time, away from some very, very important work, and those were the two wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And it It just seemed to me inappropriate to allow this to go on with so much at stake, so many of our people, men and women, serving in those countries. And so I offered my resignation to get off the front page, get out of the limelight, and let us continue with, I thought, much more important business.
But you did leave, and the United States did not go to war with Iran. Does that mean that the whole you remember how hot the conversation was, that we were on the brink. It could happen. George Bush might push it. Dick Cheney might push it. We could be at war with Iran before the end of 2008. None of that happened. Does that mean that all the talk was misguided or something else?
Well, you know, this is often the case. There's a lot of rhetoric that flies around. And sometimes things tend to get painted in very simplistic terms, black or white, yes or no. Going to be a war, not going to be a war. We're going to have peace, we're going to have a war. We're going to talk, we're going to fight. This is not realistic. It's not the way things really are. These issues are highly complex. And the reality, in my view, is that when we deal in the business of international relations, we would like as a nation to be able to deal from a position of strength. And that is certainly manifested in many of our capabilities, certainly our military capabilities, but we are also very powerful economically, and we still carry an awful lot of influence politically with people. And so as we approach these problems, it's really important to remember that real solutions are going to likely result when you apply the various national capabilities in the appropriate measures. And they may be different for different situations, but the idea that you're going to do one thing and only that and not the other is just not appropriate, not realistic. And I think as we as that discussion went on, you saw that some of that rhetoric became more tempered, and we got to the point where the hyper anxiety about a conflict began to diminish. And I think we're in a position now where it's no less challenging, certainly, and it appears that Iran has made continued progress in their quest for nuclear development and I believe for nuclear weapons. And so we still have to deal with this. And you know, we're going to have to figure out, the new administration's got a lot on their plates, to set up, put ourselves in a position to be able to actually deal with it and try to influence it in a way that would be the way we'd like to see it.
You spoke of American capabilities as significant militarily and economically.
Sure.
At the same time, we've seen what's happened to our economy and many others in the last few months, and there's been a lot of talk out of the military about the wear and tear on the military, that these two wars, the price to the military that they have taken over time. Is war with Iran an option for the United States? It's always said, Hillary Clinton again yesterday, everything is on the table. But is war really an option with Iran for this country in the circumstances that we're looking at now and in the foreseeable future?
Well, first of all, I would try to get the focus off the war issue. You know, are we going to go to war or should we go to war? Now, it seems to me that's just not appropriate. That what the questions we ought to be asking ourselves are, what is it that we want to see in this very volatile but important region in the world? What kind of a future for ourselves and for our friends and allies and for all the peoples in this region? How do we get there? What's the best course of action to try to generally achieve stability and security, which is what I believe are our major interests in the region, and then to work through the numerous issues that are troubling people in this area. There are a lot of frictions, lots of history, as you well know, ongoing today, all the way from the Levant to Pakistan and India. And our ability to influence these in a positive manner is not going to spring from, I believe, some vector that's headed towards war, but something that's going to use our capabilities, including our military power, as a backstop, if you would, as a foundation to try to establish the kind of long-term stability that we need in this area.
Hillary Clinton spoke a lot yesterday about smart power, suggesting a different balance between military and diplomatic and the rest. Would you suggest a different balance than you've seen in the last, 8 years?
Yeah. Well, First of all, one of the lessons that I learned in spades, particularly in the last decade or so, was that situations change constantly. And I would point back to Iraq, the difference between today and events back in 2003 went through several major changes. And that's a reality. So even today, as I sit here discussing this with you, the situation I would expect is significantly different than it was 7-8 months ago when I was in the middle of it. And so I'm not going to be too anxious to dispense advice or to focus or pinpoint on exactly what steps ought to be taken. Other than that, I believe that you need to use the full range of capabilities and the mix that's appropriate to the time. Things change. You've got to have a position of strength. You have to have credibility that we mean to back up what we talk about, what we want to have happen. But fundamentally, people are not really interested in war in large measure around this world. They're interested in peace. And they're interested in things that will be done to project that desire for peace and stability. I believe that there's not a whole lot of difference among peoples in the world in their fundamental desires and aspirations. There are bad actors, no doubt about it. There are people that will, unfortunately, probably to their dying breath, fight these things and fight us and push for agendas that are not helpful. But the majority of people really want a different life.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking today with retired four-star Admiral William Fallon, former commander, U.S. Central Command, the world's hottest region, from Egypt to Pakistan, talking about U.S. global challenges right now at the dawn of the Obama era. He was named CENTCOM chief by George W. Bush, resigned a year later after criticizing talk of war with Iran. In March of last year at MacDill Air Force Base in Florida, Defense Secretary Robert Gates spoke at the ceremony where Admiral Fallon relinquished his command of CENTCOM.
When I recommended Admiral Fallon for this position, I told the president that the nation would benefit from one of the military's most experienced senior officers and one of its best strategic minds in one of the world's most complex regions.
Complex, no kidding. And here, nice words from Secretary Gates, but they sounded like words of high praise from the heart.
My admiration and respect for him and his service to our country has grown every day I have worked with him. I am here today partly as Secretary of Defense, and partly because of my admiration for Fox, and partly because I consider him a friend, and I will truly miss him.
Let's begin to turn to our listeners. Chris in Charleston, South Carolina, you're on the air with Admiral Fallon.
Hello, Admiral Fallon. First off, I'd like to thank you for your service, sir. I was born and raised in Tampa, very, very familiar with MacDill.
Tampa, which is CENTCOM headquarters, yes.
Correct, correct. And my question is very, very simple. In the history of the U.S. military, the most success that we've ever experienced, we've experienced with limited objectives, clear objectives, with a very, very clear definition. And the Middle East is classically convoluted. There are a lot of different things going on. There are a lot of elements that go into that. When we went to Iraq in the early 90s, we had very, very clear objectives in terms of routing Saddam Hussein from Kuwait. Today, the objectives seem a lot less clear, and I'm wondering what the role of the U.S. military in that environment is and how those objectives are defined.
Limited war, clear objectives. Do we have it in either of these conflicts today, Iraq and Afghanistan? Should we go to war without those, Admiral Fallon?
Well, thanks very much for the question. I certainly agree that you've got to have your objectives figured out. One of the challenges is that things change, as I mentioned earlier. And in Iraq, the situation morphed considerably from late 2002 into 2004 and beyond. And so our ability to react to those changes and to be able to refocus and reapply our capabilities to try to achieve objectives is really critical. As we look at the Middle East today, It seems to me that we have a couple of major chores that are certainly front and center on the plates of our military personnel. And I'd begin with Iraq. We still have many thousands of troops there. And they're engaged right now in basically turning over responsibility for security in this country to the Iraqi security forces. And that's a very, very challenging task. They're well into it. I'm very pleased from what I can see from my position outside now on how we're doing. But it's critical that we continue to do this in an orderly fashion, that we support the growing young institutions of government in Iraq, and give it our best shot. And then we'll have to reassess, of course, as that situation changes over the next year or so, to see just exactly what kind of a legacy we end up leaving in terms of people or material or whatever support. We also have, of course, activities in Afghanistan that are in a period of flux right now. And at the same time, we're trying to do our best to deter Iran from nuclear ambitions and, of course, support our friends and neighbors and allies in this region. So there's lots to do for the military. I expect we're going to be engaged in this region for quite a while. And certainly some significant tasks for our people.
You said a couple of months ago, you were quoted in the Boston Globe saying that the war in Iraq is essentially over. Would you still say that today? And what does that mean?
Well, in terms of the major combat activities, I believe that's the case. And the statistics seem to bear this out. Thankfully, our casualties are way down now. The number of incidents of violence substantially down from back when I was the commander. And that's been a steady progression for the good. And we would hope that continues. So what I meant there is that the kind of activities that we saw throughout late 2006, all through 2007, pretty much wrapped up now. And we are, again, primarily focused on maintaining security and stability in those areas. There's still some tough areas in the country.
What's your assessment of the risk of backsliding, of things falling apart? How sturdy is this diminished violence and relative stability?
Well, the trends have been in place for some time now. And my observation is that the Iraqi security forces have been growing in capability, in numbers, in their ability to execute, in their experience, and so forth. So my expectation is that they're going to continue to improve and take this. It's never going to be like the U.S. in many respects. It's a different country, different people, different culture, so forth. But I would expect that, by and large, the Iraqis will be able to take care of business on their own. And I think this is, as we look to the future, an area of great potential for us. Think of things like a few years down the road from maybe a decade ago when Iraq was the biggest thorn in our side in the entire region, and now there's the potential they could be very, very strong supporters and allies and in cooperating in trying to expand stability in the region. So I think there's a lot of promise there. It's still work to be done, and clearly it's a dangerous part of the world, but I'm optimistic that it's going to work out.
You've said that Afghanistan is probably a bigger challenge than Iraq. You just said it's in flux, but of course we've heard high-placed voices saying recently, you know, we could lose this thing. We're not necessarily winning in Afghanistan. You call it flux, but just how unsettled, dangerous is the situation there?
Well, the first comment I'd make is that it's very different than Iraq in many, many respects. But that said, we are trying to provide the kind of stability and security that will enable the Afghan government to succeed in governance in a place that, frankly, there's not been a terrific history of a strong central government that's been successful.
Is it doable then?
I think it is doable, and it's doable for a couple of reasons. One, that the people fundamentally don't like the Taliban, for one. They've had a taste of this very repressive regime, and they don't like it.
The Pashtuns keep kind of having them seep back into their areas.
But I believe that a lot of the so-called Taliban are also locals that align with the Taliban or with al-Qaeda instigators and others for local reasons. And if you remember that this is a very, very rugged country and its people are widely dispersed, They have longtime allegiances by culture and background and history to local leaders as opposed to the central government. But on the other hand, having had a dose of the Taliban for a number of years and seeing the evils that they perpetrated on their own society, they're not really keen on it. One measure that I would point to or statistic, if you look at the number of children that are in school in this country, and remember that this is a place that the vast majority of people, probably two-thirds of them, are illiterate still. But the people have an instinct that they want something better for their children, and so they go to extraordinary lengths to try to get them into schools, and that's been a big success. So I think there's an awful lot of work to be done. I think there is a tremendous amount of potential here for us to engage with allies and partners around the world to actually get some cooperative work going on in Afghanistan. One of the things I observed is lots of frictions, lots of people that were there to help, but not particularly as coordinated in the fashion that would really be helpful. So I think the other factor is that you've got a government led by President Karzai that is trying to do a lot of things at the same time. You also have a security force that's very small relative to the size of the country and relative to the forces in Iraq. But they're tough guys. They're experienced guys. Their leaders all were part of the Mujahideen during the war against the Soviets, and so they understand how things are done. And I've observed that although many of their leaders come from different parts of the country, different tribes, in the army, they seem to get along, and not just get along, but actually cooperate and help. They know that they're going to have to work together if they're going to provide the basic stability that will enable the country to succeed.
Do you agree with the President-elect Barack Obama when he says, this is the central battlefield, here we have to win in Afghanistan, there's no choice? Or do you fear quagmire? I mean, the British couldn't really bring it to heel. The Soviets certainly couldn't. Can we?
Well, I think we can certainly help. At the end of the day, it's going to have to be the Afghan people that decide their own future. They're going to have to decide who they put their faith and trust in terms of leadership and just how badly they want these freedoms and these opportunities for the future. We can certainly help. And the fact that we will now have a little bit of pressure off of our forces coming out of Iraq, there may be an opportunity to provide some more military muscle in areas that it's needed. But I think by and large, the future here is going to be determined by the Afghan people and particularly by the Afghan security forces. And one of our major efforts there in the country is to train and equip these people to be able to do the job. And that's where I think we're going to see most of the effort.
We'll look at the Pakistan side of that equation, but let me take a call first from Toronto. Mike, you're on the air with Admiral William Fallon.
Yes. Hello, Tom, and thanks for having the Admiral on. Hello, Admiral. I wanted to ask you, we've heard in the New York Times recently there was a report that the United States thwarted attempts by Israel to strike out against Iran. And so far, in this discussion, we haven't heard much about Israel's ongoing military operation in the Gaza. But if I may ask you, do you think the situation in the Gaza could further deteriorate, and perhaps we're seeing a kind of a rehearsal for a possible Israeli military operation against Iran eventually? And what would the United States do in such an eventuality?
A lot to look at there. Let us take up the Iran piece first. David Sanger, New York Times, reporting that Israel asked for American bunker buster bombs and flyover permission for Iraq to go after Iran's nuclear program, and that President Bush denied that. Was that on your watch? Do you agree? Did it happen? And are you glad that these things were denied?
Yeah, I'm not going to comment on the Sanger piece directly, but I will talk about Iran and some of the issues that Mike raised. First of all, I would say that I don't believe this is any kind of a warm-up or a prelude to an Israeli attack on Iran. Certainly, the Iranian situation presents a major challenge to the Israeli government, the Israeli people. Their very, very hostile rhetoric and continued bombastic statements that basically would threaten verbally the existence of the State of Israel.
I know you don't want to comment on the article, but are you saying that Israel, in fact, hasn't had plans, doesn't, won't? I mean, the article was pretty specific that they wanted it, they pounded the table for it, they didn't get it.
Well, I couldn't imagine that that Israel wouldn't have plans, as we have plans for all kinds of potential contingencies. That's one of the responsibilities of our military commanders in the various regions, is to look at possibilities and to think through them and have their people work through them. So there's always planning going on, and that's pretty much a normal course of business. But I think the challenges for Israel are many, and having just had the opportunity to revisit Israel a few weeks ago and to get refreshed firsthand from people over there on their views, there's an awful lot of anxiety, and justifiably so, because they're threatened not only by Iranian pressure from the outside, but by their ongoing challenges from the Palestinians, and particularly from Gaza now with Hamas. And so it seems to me that as I look at these challenges that they face, probably the number one issue would be dealing with the Palestinians and trying to figure out a way to move forward, provide for their own security long term, and also recognize that there's certainly some needs on the part of the Palestinians. But it's very difficult when you have to deal with organizations like Hamas.
Admiral, what about the impact of what we've seen in Gaza in recent weeks? The death toll there are now approaching 1,000, about half of those civilians, women and children. Broadcast all over the Arab world of the images of civilians cowering, bleeding, and all the rest. Everybody has heard Israel's message about its vulnerability, how it has to do what it has to do. Nevertheless, you know the power of those images, and we've all heard the anger and coming out of the Arab world. What's the impact for the United States and the U.S. agenda in this region of the Israeli operation in Gaza?
Well, it certainly is challenging, because as these images, and I have to say that from my experience in the Middle East, and particularly in Iraq, that certainly in Iraq, our enemies there tried their darndest to take full advantage of the computer age and the information technology to put out reports and to provide information that was certainly favorable to their view and not to ours. And so,
but there's a lot to photograph here. There's a lot to video, right?
Well, yeah, and the extent to which this is going on in Gaza, I don't know. But the facts are that as we contemplate the effects this is having on us and the future, I think it would be wise to remember that there's a lot of history here, and there are a lot of facts that tend to be forgotten, and distortions that come up from time to time on all sides. And if we're going to try to solve some of these very significant problems, it's going to require a very, very strong, dedicated effort, and it's going to require time. And if I could, to mention, when I was in Israel last month, I was fortunate to be in the company of former U.S. Senator George Mitchell, who had extensive experience, as many of you know, in dealing with the challenges in Ireland. And his comments were, I think, very, very appropriate. This is very difficult work, and it takes a long time, and there's no guarantees, but it requires dedication on both sides to reach the appropriate compromises if we're going to get the kind of results you'd like to see.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking today with retired four-star Admiral William J. Fox Fallon, former commander, U.S. Central Command, the world's hottest region, from Egypt to Pakistan, talking about U.S. global challenges right now at the dawn of the Obama era. Let's go to Des Moines, Iowa, and Pete. Pete, you're on the air with William Fallon.
Hi, Admiral. I'm a retired Navy officer. I was once an intelligence briefer for the Joint Chiefs when I retired. I always feel as if patience, soft power, and is far better than preemptive war. and that Iraq would have, the people of Iraq would have brought down that government themselves if given time. It worked this worked against the Soviets, and it should work in the Middle East.
Pete, thanks very much. Admiral Fallon, preemptive war. We've just done it in Iraq. We're still in the midst of it. What lessons do you take from that? And Pete says he'd rather have soft power and patience. Is that the recipe now? Is that the recipe for Barack Obama?
Well, I have to tell you that as a career military person, I believe that you got to take care of fundamentals and basics. And as a professional military officer, those fundamentals include having our forces prepared to the best of our ability for whatever contingencies arise. And so I'm all for using all the instruments of national power. And
preemptively?
I caution the business of trying to draw a harsh distinction between soft and hard. I believe you need to have both. And you'd certainly like to convince people to do what you'd like them to do without having to use military force. But people have to understand that if at the end of the day, if that appears to be the only way that we can remove a threat that we think is particularly challenging to us, that we reluctantly, but we might have to do it. So I think that I would prefer to keep moving forward on multiple fronts and to make sure that our forces keep their powder dry, if you would, but also to be fully prepared to engage to the extent, full extent of our capabilities.
Are you willing to discuss preemption as American military policy? It was exercised in the George W. Bush administration in a rare example in Iraq. Are you willing to draw any conclusion or say anything about how you look at that as the former chief of CENTCOM?
Well, I'd say, first of all, that this is, again, a very complex issue, and the idea that it was just we'll go preempt something. If you think back to the times, this was not very long after 9/11.
But George Bush explicitly stated this as policy. He went to West Point. He made a speech. Yeah. He raised it as American policy henceforth. Good idea or not?
Well, I think it was, again, be careful the context that these things are taken in, this administration felt that there could be circumstances in which we might find it in the interest of the nation that we would have to do something in advance of actually being attacked directly by some threat. Now that's as policies certainly are reviewed with each administration. People go back and look and see how effective past policies were and what they achieved and what alternatives are. And I think this is one of the benefits of having new administrations from time to time is that you get a review, and in some cases a complete review from the top down. What I've found over the years is that there are aspects of most of these policies across the board that end up being retained for one reason or another. There are other things that you tend to emphasize and others that you de-emphasize. There's also a major issue, and that has certainly been apparent in recent years around the world, is that the perception of our policy and what we were actually going to do or what we might do certainly seemed to be very negative in many respects from many people. And so this is one of the challenges the new administration is going to have to look at to see if they want to continue that vein or what they want to put the things in a different light. And again, I emphasize perceptions, which tend to drive opinions. May not be completely based on facts, but then again, it's what people believe, and they become major determinants of your ability to get things done in the world.
Let's go to Danny in Charleston, South Carolina. Danny, you're on the air.
Yes. First of all, thank the general for serving country. And I got a comment and a question. Comment is the Iranian never had in the history any problem or any fight with Israel. And the question was, Israel at this moment playing tic for tac all these years, what they're really trying to accomplish? Are they going to accomplish anything this time? And another thing, is it surprising the timing of it when President Bush leaving, right away they did it, because I don't think Obama...
Danny, you're breaking up on us, but I think we've got the gist of it. Iran and Israel asking, what is Israel really trying to accomplish in Gaza, in your view? And what about the timing of this move on and into Gaza? How do you interpret those, Admiral Fallon?
Okay, I do the timing first, since I was actually in the country when the rockets began, and that's really what instigated this this latest move.
Well, rockets have gone on for a long time, though. Right?
Well, but there had been a general ceasefire for quite a few months, and it had been certainly welcomed and generally enforced, but that began to break down, and more and more rockets began to fly,
But this wasn't planned overnight. You
know? Well, I don't know. You never know what goes on in this part of the world in terms of what people have in their minds. But I think mm-hmm. the facts are, as I understand them, mm-hmm. that the Hamas folks started to fire rockets, which was basically breaking the agreement, the ceasefire agreement, and then the Israelis reacted. Now, the business of tit for tat.
Just stick with timing for a second, because it's been so widely said that Israel wanted to get this action in before George W. Bush left office, because he's been very supportive right across the board with Israel, and they feared Barack Obama might be less supportive, might even one way or another bar this action.
Yeah,
Do you not buy that?
No, I don't buy that. I think that's possible, but pretty unlikely. And again, what appears to be driving this, and if you would accept, which I think our caller seems to imply, that the Israelis have been engaged in the tit for tat business for a long time, that there was a series of strikes and they responded to it. But I think back to the more important issue of what's the future and what how do you deal with this stuff? The Israelis feel a need to react tactically to try to protect their own people and stop these rockets. I understand that from a military standpoint. The other key issue will be the big picture, long-term plan. You know, how do you end this? How do you keep from an endless cycle of tit for tat? And that is the real challenge, and that's the thing that the leadership, certainly in Israel, is going to have to take on. And the new administration, I'm sure, is going to be looking for ways to try to be helpful in that area.
There's a cost to Israel in that cycle. There's a cost to the Palestinians. What's the cost to the United States from a military commander's point of view of that, what you call, endless cycle of tit-for-tat between Israelis and Palestinians?
Sure. Well, you get a continuation of instability, and you have reasons for people to, again, perceptions start to come to the fore here, to say, here it is, it's still going on. And there's also this idea in some quarters that the U.S., while some would like to denigrate us and diminish our capabilities, others have this interesting idea that with a wave of our hands, we can solve all problems. And, of course, the truth is somewhere decidedly in the middle there. But the longer this kind of stuff goes on, it just fuels bitterness and hatred, not just amongst those in the immediate vicinity, but it gives others that are looking for excuses, reasons to point and say, see. So
in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Exactly, and other places around the world. So this is the real long-term challenge here.
Let's go to Jackie in Melrose, Massachusetts. Jackie, you're on the air with Admiral Fallon.
Hi, Admiral. It was wonderful a few minutes ago to hear you trying to avoid even using the words war. That was wonderful to hear. Since our invasion in Iraq, 1 million Iraqis who had never done anything to harm us have died, 1 million of our fellow human beings. How can we avoid this in the future, especially considering that our Constitution says Congress maintains the army, the militia, meaning the military, for just two reasons, to suppress an insurrection or repel an invasion? How have we gone so far to have so many of these wars around the world against countries that have never harmed us at all? 8 wars since World War II.
Admiral Fallon?
Avoid this in the future.
Well, that's a noble idea, but I'm afraid that we're probably going to be stuck with wars for some time. If you were to look at the overall trends, you might be surprised to find that in the last half century, the actual levels of violence, numbers of people impacted, numbers of incidents and so forth are actually trending down, and that's a positive direction. It'd be nice to not have to engage in these things. I've certainly seen more than my share during my service, but I think the reality is that, unfortunately, we still have some bad people in the world, people with evil intentions, and they will stop at nothing. And so we have to maintain some significant military strength to be able to deal with this. That said, as you know, as you've certainly heard from discussions today, it seems to me the priority is on solving these problems and solving them without resorting to violence.
There's a lot of concern right now about civilians in Gaza and Israel. Jackie threw out the number 1 million Iraqis dead for Iraq. As former CENTCOM commander, there's all kinds of estimates. How do you look at that number, that toll?
Yeah, I don't know. no clue about the accuracy of that number. But what I focused on was how things were in the hour and the day when I was the commander. I felt that I couldn't do a whole lot about the past, but I was certainly going to focus on things at the present time and then in the future. And so we worked very hard to try to limit certainly the number of casualties, but sometimes casualties regrettably are unavoidable, and we did our best. But the idea, the measures that I followed were the trend lines. Were we getting better? Were we able to diminish the levels of violence? Were we able to, more importantly, expand those areas of stability and security? And thankfully, those trends were generally in a very positive direction, with a concomitant lowering of casualties, both military and civilian.
Let's go to Josh in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Josh, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Admiral, I wanted to ask regarding Afghanistan. We had a very interesting strategy in the 80s against the Soviets of supporting the Mujahideen, in which the Soviets ended up thinking they were fighting a ragtag insurgency that was secretly well-funded and equipped. Is there any chance of that still being the case in Afghanistan, that we're not actually fighting a relatively small insurgency in the Taliban, but there might be significant support behind them? And if that is the case, who we might really be fighting with there?
Admiral Fallon?
Yeah, I don't think so. I think we've got a pretty good handle on who they are and what they're fighting for, and there are lots of reasons. But I don't see some great hand behind all this. They get support from various folks around the world, but by and large, it's Al-Qaeda instigated, certainly coming across the border from Pakistan, and the local tribesmen who will take help from anybody. And it included, certainly when I was out there, some help from the Iranians, but there's no major muscle mover that I can see behind this. It's
what about Pakistan itself, or elements within Pakistan? We saw just in the last few days, again, New York Times' David Sanger reporting on the vulnerability of Pakistan's nuclear weaponry itself to potential, Islamist snatch and grab at some point. What about the fissures within Pakistan, how they're playing out?
Well, this is a really good point, Tom. Pakistan is a very unstable country with a difficult history ever since its inception. Many, many issues, and we certainly have seen a parade of those over the last couple of years. The major issues in my mind are, first of all, the long-term grinding issues with India, and the fact that these two countries came into being at the same time, and lots of nasty history here, but they have fought several wars and both are nuclear armed. And the extent to which Pakistan and the leadership in Pakistan has viewed India as their number one enemy seems to me to be not appropriate. And certainly my observation would be in the last few years that the trend lines have been generally better with the
those two
possible exception of
Mumbai
recent mm-hmm. couple of months. But generally, things have been improving, and that's really good. And certainly when I was in command and my visits to Pakistan and discussions with the leaders, I certainly tried to highlight what I thought the number one threat was, and it wasn't India. It was, in fact, these insurgents and these extremists who were operating inside of Pakistan, not only against our forces in Afghanistan, but as it turns out, in large measure against the Pakistani people. And so I believe that the situation, the vision of the situation, the understanding was changing, certainly up until the Mumbai events of recent days, and that the people were, in fact, recognizing this very, very significant challenge that came from extremists within Pakistan. Extremely difficult to draw lines between Afghanistan and Pakistan, the borders, about as rugged as you'll find anywhere in the world. And there are Pashtun tribal folks on both sides of the border who really prefer to be able to freely transit back and forth. And there are elements within these tribal areas in which we believe al-Qaeda is hunkered down, their leadership. They get support from the locals, and it's a long-term problem that's probably going to be top of the agenda for the new administration.
Got 15 seconds. If you had it with Barack Obama on the issues of war and peace, what's your word to the wise, to the president-elect?
Well, far be it for me to try prescribe. Certainly, the incoming president, I believe, has a very good awareness of the challenges, the many issues, particularly in the Central Command region. But along with these challenges, I think there's some opportunities. Long-term peace and stability, long-term resolution of India-Pakistan, maybe the Israeli situation. There's a lot of potential here.
A lot of work to do.
Best of luck.
Admiral William J. Fallon, thank you for joining us. This is On Point.